"You had charge of the boat that brought you down from Weisei?" he said in calm, monotonous tones, turning round and raising his brows at the scribe Kamat. Upon the latter's assent, he looked at Joseph. "You are the former steward of the great courtier Petipre?" he asked. "I am he," answered Joseph in all simplicity. And yet this was rather a strong answer. He might have replied, "As you have said," or, "My lord knows the truth," or, more floridly, "Ma'at speaks out of your mouth." But in the first place, just, "I am he," spoken, of course, quite simply, but with a sober smile, was a little incorrect. One did not speak in the first person to superiors, but said, "Your servant," or with even greater self-disparagement, "this servant here." And in the second place, the "I" was too prominent. Associated with the "he," it roused a vague suspicion that it referred to more than merely the stewardship which was all that was in question. There was an implication that question and answer did not quite match, that the answer overlapped the question, and might tempt the questioner to another question, "What are you?" or even, "Who are you?" over and above that. The truth is, Joseph's answer was a formula, old, familiar, and widely appealing from ages past. It was the time-honored revelation of identity, a ritual statement beloved in song and story and play, in which the gods had parts. In such a play, it is used in order to string together a whole gamut of effects and plot sequences, from mere casting down of the eyes to being thundered at and flung to one's knees. My Sakme's placid features, the features of a man not prone to alarm, did show a faint confusion or embarrassment. It made the end of his small hooked nose turn whitish. "Yes, yes, so you are," said he. Possibly at the moment he did not know himself just what he meant by that, and if so, the fact that this man before him was the handsomest 27-year-older in the two lands may have contributed to his absence of mind. Beauty is impressive. Unfailingly it stirs a special kind of faint trepidation even in the most placid soul from whom fear in general is remote. A simple, "I am he," uttered with a sober smile, might be magnified by the beauty of the speaker into something a little unearthly. "You seem to be a light-headed bird," went on the captain, "falling out of the nest out of sheer foolishness and lack of balance. Lived up there in Pharaoh's city, where life is so full of interest that it could have been a perpetual feast day for you, and for nothing, and less than nothing, you have got yourself sent down here to us, where there is nothing to, nothing but nothingness. Here, utter boredom reigns," said he, and gathered his brows in a momentary frown, accompanied, however, by a half-smile, as though smile and frown belonged together. "Were you ignorant," he went on, "that in the stranger's house one should not seek out the women with one's eyes? Have you not read the precepts in the Book of the Dead, or the teachings and sayings of the holy Imhotep?" "They are familiar to me," Joseph replied, "for I have read them countless times aloud and to myself." But the captain, though he had asked for an answer, was not listening to it. "That was a man," said he, turning to his companion, the chaplain, "a good companion for life. Imhotep the Wise, physician, architect, priest, and scribe, all in one. Tutankhjehuti, the living image of Tot. I venerate the man, that I must say. If it were given to me to be appalled, which it is not, perhaps I ought to say unfortunately, I am much too easy-going for that, but if I could, I should certainly be appalled at such encyclopedic wisdom. He died long years ago, Imhotep the Divine. His like existed only in early times, and in the morning of the two lands. His sovereign was an early king named Djoser, whose eternal dwelling he is known to have built, the stepped pyramid near Menfe, 6 stories high, some 120 ells. But the limestone is poor. Ours up in the quarry where the convicts work is better stuff. The master just had no better to his hand. But the art of building was only a small part of his knowledge and skill. He knew all the locks and keys to the temple of Tot. Skilled in medicine he was, too, and adept in nature's matters, with knowledge of solids and liquids. He had a gentle hand with the sick, and could relieve folk groaning and tossing with pain. He himself must have been very tranquil by nature, and not prone to fear. Added to all this, he was a reed in the hand of God, a writer of wisdom. But his talents worked together, not today a doctor and tomorrow a writer, but both in one and at the same time. I emphasize this because it is, to my mind, a surpassing virtue. Medicine and writing go well together. They shed light on each other, and both do better by going hand in hand. A doctor possessed of the writer's art will be the better consoler to anyone rolling in agony. Conversely, a writer who understands the life of the body, its powers and its pains, its fluids and functions, its blessings and banes, has a great advantage over him who knows nothing of such things. Imhotep was such a doctor and such a writer, a godlike man. They ought to burn incense to him, and I think when he's been dead a while longer, they will. Anyhow, he also lived in Menfe, a very stimulating city. "You need not blush before him, Captain," replied the high priest, "for aside from your military service, you practice the art of healing. You do good to those who wreathe and writhe, and besides that, write very winningly in form and matter, while uniting all these branches in perfect serenity." "Serenity by itself does not do it," answered my Sakme, and the serenity of his own face with its shrewd round eyes altered a shade into the pensive. "Perhaps I just need to get good and scared once. But how could that happen?" "And you," he said suddenly. He lifted his brows and shook his head as he looked over at Petipre's 2 house slaves who were holding the ends of Joseph's bonds. "What are you doing there? Are you going to plow with him, or play horse like little boys? I suppose your ex-steward is to do time at hard labor with his limbs tied up like a calf for the slaughter? Untie him, stupids. Here we work hard for Pharaoh. In the quarry, or on the new buildings. We don't lie about in bonds. What lack of understanding. These people," he explained aside to the man of God, "live in the belief that a prison is a place where one lies about in chains. They take everything literally, that is their way, and stick to the letter as children do. If they hear about somebody that he lies in jail, that being the phrase in common use, they firmly believe that the man has been plumped into some hole full of hungry rats and rattling chains, where he lies and steals days from Ray. Such confusion of the word and the reality is, to my way of thinking, characteristic of low breeding and lack of education. I have often seen it in the rubber-eaters of the wretched Kush, and even in the little peasantry of our own fields, not so much in the towns. To be sure, there is a certain poetry in the literal interpretation, the simple poetry of the fairy tale. There are, so far as I can see, 2 kinds of poetry. One springs from folk simplicity, the other from the literary gift in essence. The second is undoubtedly the higher form, but in my view, it cannot flourish cut off from the other, needing it as a plant needs soil. Just as all the beauty of the higher life and the splendor of Pharaoh himself need the earth mold of all our poverty-stricken existences in order to flower and flourish and be an amazement to the world. "As scholar of the bookhouse," said Kamat, scribe of the buffet, who meanwhile had hastened to free Joseph's elbows with his own hands, "I have no part in any confusion between the phrase and the reality. And only for form's sake, and for the moment, I thought I had to deliver the prisoner in bonds. He himself will tell you that during the greater part of the voyage, I let him go free. That was no more than sensible, responded my sakme, since there are differences between crimes. Murder, theft, trespass, refusal to pay taxes, or conniving with the tax collector, those are in a different class from offenses where a woman is concerned, which require a more discreet handling. He half unrolled the letter again and looked at it. Here, he said, I see a woman comes into it, and as an officer and a pupil of the royal stables, I cannot put it in the same boat with vulgar crimes. We have said that it is a sign of lack of elevation or maturity to take everything literally, and not to distinguish between the phrase and the reality. But such a distinction is now and again unavoidable among the better sort of people. For instance, it is said that in the house of strangers it is dangerous to cast eyes upon the women. Yet even so, it is done, because wisdom is one thing and life another. And you might even say that the element of risk makes it to some extent honorable. Again, there are two parties to a love affair, and that always obscures the issue a bit. From the outside, it looks as though the case were clear. That is because one side, I mean the man, of course, always takes the blame on himself. Yet again, it may be best to make a distinction in private between the phrase and the reality. When I hear of a woman being led astray by a man, I chuckle to myself, for it sounds like a joke, and I think, by the great triad, because after all, we know whose business seduction has been since the time of the gods, and it was not the business of us stupid men. Do you know the story of the two brothers? He turned to face Joseph, looking up at him with his round brown eyes, for he was considerably shorter, as well as stoutish in build. He lifted his thick brows again as high as they would go, as though that would help to strike a balance. "I know it well, my lord," answered Joseph, "for I had often to read it aloud to my master, Pharaoh's friend, and I also had to copy it out fair for him with black and red ink." "It will continue to be copied," said the commandant. "It is a capital invention, not only in its style, which carries conviction, even though the episodes are really almost incredible when one thinks them over calmly. For instance, where the queen conceives through a splinter which flies into her mouth from the wood of the persia tree, which is too contradictory to medical experience to be taken literally. But despite that, the story is lifelike, as when the wife of Anup leans against the youth Bata, finding him great in strength, and says to him, 'Come, let us have joy in each other for a little, and I will make thee two feast-day garments.' And when Bata cries to his brother, 'Woe is me, she is turned all to ill,' and before his eyes cuts off his manhood with the blade of the sword reed and gives it to the fishes to eat, that is thrilling. Later on, the narrative degenerates and becomes unbelievable. Yet it is edifying, too, when Bata turns himself into the Hapi bull and speaks, 'I shall be a wonder of a Hapi, and the whole land will exult in me,' and makes himself known and says, 'I am Bata. Lo, I live still, and am the sacred bull of God.' Those are, of course, fantastic inventions. But yet how plastically life does sometimes pour itself into the most extraordinary forms of the creative fancy.